Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
State lawmakers want to make it harder for families that rely on temporary cash assistance, but most Floridians on the program are kids, which has critics of the bill worried.
Again, we're putting children at risk of falling into the child welfare system.
Also tonight, supporters of Florida's community and state colleges say their mission and typical student is quite different from the state university systems.
The average age is 31. It is not our typical university student in any way. They're working while they're studying.
We'll also learn about new transparency rules being considered for the state's assisted living facilities and the move to crack down on drug-addled racing dogs. It's midweek in week two of this year's Florida legislative session. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers want to tighten the rules for low-income families getting cash assistance. Kate Payne reports a bill moving in the House would withhold benefits longer for those who don't meet work requirements.
Florida families making 185% of the federal poverty limit or less can qualify for temporary cash assistance, or TANF. The vast majority of Floridians on this program are kids under the age of 18, but eligible adults generally have to meet work requirements like on-the-job hours, training, job searching, or providing child care. Now state lawmakers want to crack down on people who aren't complying with those rules. Cape Coral Republican Dane Eagle is sponsoring the bill in the House.
The noncompliance sanctions will be tighter. They'll align with the food stamp restrictions rather than the temporary cash assistance ones. But again, we're trying to make it easier to comply. Not necessarily easier, but more efficient and find ways to work with them one-on-one so they understand what it is, so they're getting back to work and back on their feet. The aim is to not sanction people. The aim is to find ways to work with them.
If parents miss work once, they would lose out on benefits for 1 month. Miss work twice, it's 3 months. Three times, it's 6 months. They would get job training and counseling, and children of disqualified parents would still qualify for a certain period of time, but eventually their benefits would run out too. Eagle's bill would also expand the places benefit or EBT cards can't be used.
When it comes to EBT cards, there are certain areas or certain places that those are not allowed, traditionally, such as gambling, places where alcohol is sold. We're adding to that medical marijuana dispensaries. We're adding tobacco shops and piercing and tattoo parlors.
There are plenty of valid reasons why someone might miss work, like medical or family emergencies, court appearances, and lack of transportation or child care. But even with those exceptions, Eagle says some recipients aren't cooperating.
So it comes to a point where people that, with these changes, are not complying are doing it because they simply don't want to. And if there are cases where that is not happening, we need to fix that and try to find ways to work with them. But for those who refuse to comply, who just don't want to work with us and continue this partnership, there's no reason we should be giving them cash handouts.
For reference, a state analysis shows the most a family of four could get in a month is $364. Even for those who just aren't complying, Karen Woodall says the sanctions are too much. She's with the Florida Center for Fiscal and Economic Policy.
And as we work together to try to make sure that it's a more seamless system and that people actually have the support to get the jobs and get off of the program, I would encourage us to let's give that a try first before we start increasing penalties. Because, again, we're putting children at risk of falling into the child welfare system.
And again, the vast majority of Floridians on this program are needy children. Cindy Huddleston with Florida Legal Services doesn't want them to be punished.
And more importantly, because it sanctions the children of parents who are non-cooperative for after a specified period of time for what can be indefinite or even a permanent disqualification.
The bipartisan plan has backing in both chambers, and a House committee overwhelmingly voted it forward Wednesday. But even with supporters, there are some caveats. Here's Wellington Democratic Representative Matt Wilhite.
I think we do have some people that are very concerned about some of these changes and how far they go, and their concerns about that we don't have enough data from previous research to already be moving forward. So, again, I'm going to support it going forward, but I appreciate your openness and willingness to talk about this and know that hopefully through the process we can make this better.
The plan has two more committee stops in the House, but it hasn't had a single hearing in the Senate. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
Florida's public community and state colleges could become their own system and move from under the authority of the State Board of Education, but with that newfound independence would come strict caps on the number of students who can enroll in bachelor's degree programs at those schools, and also make it harder for community and state colleges to establish such programs. We get that story from Lynn Hatter.
The proposal is the brainchild of Senate President Joe Negron, who in the past has criticized Florida's community and state colleges for mission creep, stepping into roles they weren't designed for. And despite Governor Rick Scott vetoing one of his top priorities last year, that view has not changed. Negron has seen the proliferation of bachelor's degree programs, along with sometimes confusing name changes at the schools, as a problem in a system where they're increasingly competing with the state's public universities for funding. This year's proposal is Senate Bill 540, brought by Republican Senator Dorothy Huegel, who says
that the bill is meant to strengthen the community colleges, to provide them with advocacy and support, to help them fulfill their primary mission.
To that end, Huegel's proposal would cap the number of students that can enroll in bachelor's degrees at the colleges and lengthen the time it takes for the schools to start the process for creating a new one. But Republican Senator Gary Farmer wants to know why the additional time.
I was surprised that there were separate dates for notice of interest and intent. And to me, the 100 days of notice of intent would seems to me at least to be plenty of time for other stakeholders to weigh in and for the consideration to be made.
Huegel says the addition gives universities more time to respond to proposals. This year, same as last, Florida's community and state colleges stand in opposition. During a recent interview, College System Chancellor Madeline Pumariega said the schools are already focused on local workforce needs and that the system is already doing most of what the bill mandates, like inking transfer agreements with universities.
For example, 2+2, our colleges all have, our 28 colleges have articulation agreements with each of our universities. So we're doing that. Performance incentive programs, our colleges implemented that, and we continue to refine that process.
At issue are questions over who is being served and how. The community and state colleges contend their programs do not compete with universities, that they serve mostly older students or those returning to school, and that the bachelor's degrees being offered are ones that respond to local needs.
The reality is that the student who pursues the baccalaureate program at one of our colleges, the average age is 31. It is not our typical university student in any way. They're working while they're studying. They're balancing life responsibilities with work and children or aging parents. So we have an obligation to our local communities and to those students to help them find and complete a degree.
But what is of concern to college presidents this time around are changing metrics, the matrix used by the state to determine how colleges get performance-based funds. And Palm Beach State College President Ava Parker is also worried about shifting the college system from under the State Board of Education.
And because we have local boards who understand our differences, that it's important that we preserve that. And we believe that the Constitution is really the best avenue which should do that. We think when we go through legislation, it turns out that it gets changed annually, often based upon who is in charge. And it would make more sense, we think, if it were in the Constitution, and then from there we can codify in legislation.
House Speaker Richard Corcoran has expressed support for the proposal, and it has so far cleared its Senate hearings with majority votes in favor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, some Florida lawmakers want to find a way around the Electoral College.
All public officials in this country are elected by popular vote, except one, and that's the President of the United States.
And we'll have part two of our chat with well-known Republican strategist Rick Wilson, including his take on the Florida legislature during a very critical election year.
They're always going to be questioned as to, are you doing this because you are, you know, seeking the good of the state? Or are you doing this as part of a, you know, to make campaign ads from?
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
Two Democratic lawmakers are hoping Florida gets involved in a movement that would change the way Floridians vote for the President of the United States, Sasha Cordner reports.
Under the current Electoral College system, Floridians essentially vote for a group of electors. If a Republican presidential candidate, for example, wins the popular vote in Florida, the GOP candidate would then gain the state's 29 electoral votes. And the presidential candidate needs a total of 270 or more from all states to win. But some say the process should be much simpler.
In every country around the world that has a democracy, except this one, the person who gets the most votes wins. I mean, it's just that simple. This should not be a complicated issue.
That's Dania Beach Democratic Representative Joe Geller, who's sponsoring a bill to change that system. He wants Florida to join what's called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. It would guarantee the presidency to the candidate who receives the popular vote in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. Geller says it's not a Democrat or Republican issue, as several states with GOP-controlled legislatures have also agreed to be part of the compact.
So we think that there is a real groundswell of support after having a circumstance where twice in 16 years, the person who got the most votes did not become the president.
After the 2000 presidential election, George W. Bush became the president despite losing the popular vote to Al Gore. Then there's this past presidential election when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, but Donald Trump became the president through the electoral votes. So far, 10 states in the District of Columbia have signed on to the compact. According to that movement, it actually has to go through the electoral voting process to go into effect. So with the states that have signed on, the compact has 165 of the 270 electoral votes needed for it to go into effect.
With 165 electoral votes currently committed to the National Popular Vote Compact, a large battleground state like Florida joining in this multi-state electoral effort will make having a national popular vote of president more likely for the 2020 elections.
That's Orlando Democrat Victor Torres, the bill's Senate sponsor, who says his measure is needed for future elections.
Florida continues to grow in population, and new Hispanics and nonpartisan voters now constitute nearly one-third of all of Florida's voters. In recent presidential elections, almost half of Florida's voters did not count because of the winner-take-all system of awarding electoral delegates.
Still, both the House and Senate measures have not yet had a committee hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
After the destructive repercussions Hurricane Irma had on Florida's elderly residents, a new bill looks to address the key issue as to why they were so negatively affected, as Andrew Quintana reports.
In the wake of Hurricane Irma, many Florida nursing home residents faced life-threatening conditions. In the most high-profile case, 14 residents passed away in a Hollywood nursing home after a broken air conditioning system left the building in sweltering heat. Some nursing homes and assisted living facilities did not update their contact information, leaving many families in the dark as to the condition of residents. State Representative Emily Slossberg witnessed the issue firsthand. She governs the second oldest demographic out of all the House districts in Boca Raton, which means her office handled many of the nursing home issues after the hurricane.
We were being called by family members who could not get a hold of their loved ones in these facilities. They were worried sick.
Schlossberg's House Bill 443 would force nursing homes and assisted living facilities to be more transparent with their residents and their residents' authorized representatives. Nursing homes would have to notify residents and the state long-term care ombudsman of their current contact information. In addition, if any changes are made to their contact information, they are required to notify both residents and ombudsman within 30 days. Amy Dad says that would have helped her. She says her mother died in the chaos of Hurricane Irma.
It's very distressing to have this happen to you and not be able to communicate with those you love. You can't always be here. Many people in nursing homes in Florida have people out of state and out of country. And it's so important to be able to keep that line of communication, not only for the family members, but for the person in the nursing home, because it really does raise their spirit to hear from their families and know that they care.
The bill would align Florida nursing home regulations with federal ones, allowing residents access to their own personal records 24 hours after a request and get a copy of those records within 2 days. All these things are common sense, Representative Schlossberg says.
This is common sense. There's no fiscal attached to it. It just requires when you move, all you have to do is update your information with the state ombudsman office. You know, so at least we know where you're at and the family knows where you're at. This is a consumer-friendly bill.
At a subcommittee on Wednesday, the bill passed unanimously. However, it did receive some scrutiny from Tampa Republican Representative Sean Harrison. He worries the bill shifts too much power to the state ombudsman.
My concern is by involving the ombudsman in that process, you're going to potentially give standing to another party that doesn't have standing in current law, and it could just further cause problems in that regard. So
Schlossberg says she'll work with the Florida Healthcare Association as the bill moves forward. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Andrew Quintana.
A bill that would ban the use of steroids in racing greyhounds is moving in the Florida legislature, but as the conversation gets mixed up in issues such as the state's drug testing standards and whether greyhound racing should continue at all, Regan McCarthy reports advocates are worried the measure could get bogged down.
Female racing greyhounds are given steroids to help control their heat cycle, but the practice is controversial. Orlando Democratic Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith is carrying the issue in the House.
Studies have linked its use to liver and kidney and cartilage damage, gastrointestinal problems, even shock. Because testosterone is it's derived from the male sex hormone, it can also interfere with the natural female reproductive cycle. Additional complications involving female organs and tissue can also develop.
And Tampa Republican Senator Dana Young, who's sponsoring the bill in her chamber, says the drug could also be used to fix races. She says since there's no testing for the drug now, there's no way to know.
The fact that this is gambling and this is an industry on which gambling is done, we owe it to not only the dogs for their humane treatment, but to the public to know that the races which they are betting on are done in a legal and equitable manner.
But lobbyists representing greyhound trainers and breeders insist the drug is only used as birth control on female dogs and further claim there's no danger associated with giving dogs low doses of testosterone steroids. Former Florida Lieutenant Governor Jeff Kottkamp represents the Florida Greyhound Association.
You can make a pretty good living as a dog owner, not just on the racing side of this, but on the breeding side, which is why the owners would never want to provide their dog with something that would harm the reproductive abilities of their dogs. It's in their own self-interest to do what's best for the health and welfare of the dogs. In fact, that's pretty much what drives them every day. This is how these 8,000 people make their living. They would never overtly do something to harm the animals that they not only love, but make a living from.
But Palm Bay Republican Representative Randy Fine says if that's true, he doesn't understand why the industry would fight efforts to stop the use of illegal drugs like cocaine in racing dogs.
My understanding is your group is advocating for us to legalize cocaine. And since this testosterone is supposedly good for these racing athletes, I just want to understand the consistency of how cocaine is good for these racing athletes as well.
Fine is referring to a case that's moving through the Florida court system. After a number of racing greyhounds tested positive for cocaine, industry officials took the state to court, arguing against Florida's testing practices. Industry representatives say part of the problem is that today's tests are too accurate and can detect the presence of drugs even in minuscule amounts that may have simply transferred from somewhere else. Meanwhile, another measure moving through the Senate makes a number of changes, including giving paramutuals the option to decouple other kinds of gambling from racing. Palm Coast Republican Representative Travis Hudson is behind that bill.
Some may not, and after 30 days, they're either still racing or they're decoupling, and that's how the bill is drafted. It would be up to the track to choose whether they want to or not.
Both measures are facing significant pushback from breeders, trainers, even organizations that are concerned about the expansion of gambling in the state. And Guillermo Smith says that's why lawmakers have filed these bills year after year without making it to the finish line.
Welcome to the Greyhound Swamp.
That's a sentiment it seems Brandon Republican Senator Tom Lee agrees with. He's also a member of the Florida Constitution Revision Commission and is pushing a proposal there to ban greyhound racing. Lee says with so much industry interest in the issue, a vote before the people is likely the only way the rule will move forward. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Now with a look at other Capitol action, here's Bob Brooks from our sister operation, the Florida Channel.
Scheduled to be considered by various House committees today, 11 bills regarding public records and public meetings and what is included and excluded. Here are three. House Bill 411, Public Records on Fire Safety Systems. This bill makes fire safety systems and plans for public buildings exempt from public records and public meetings. It passed the House Oversight Committee and has one more committee stop. House Bill 459, entitled Public Records, provides that some information related to agency contracts is not confidential or exempt from public records requirements, and removes or revises numerous provisions related to exemptions from public records requirements for trade secrets. It was voted favorable with a committee substitute by the House Oversight, Transparency, and Administration Subcommittee. It has one more committee stop, the Government Accountability Committee. House Bill 439, entitled Public Meetings and Records, expands exemption from public meetings requirements to allow specified entities to meet in private with an attorney to discuss imminent litigation if certain conditions are met, and it specifies when litigation is considered imminent. Along with HB 459, it too was voted favorable with a committee substitute by the House Oversight, Transparency, and Administration Subcommittee, and is headed for the Government Accountability Committee. House Bill 707, entitled Campaign Finance, sponsored by Representative Evan Jenny. This bill prohibits any statewide elected official from soliciting or accepting contributions during regular, extended, or special legislative session. This bill was voted favorable by the House Oversight, Transparency, and Administration Subcommittee. And finally, the House Pre-K-12 Quality Subcommittee considered HB 1279, the School District Accountability Bill, that among other things requires school boards to provide financial efficiency data and fiscal trend information, and requires the Department of Education to develop a web-based tool that identifies schools and districts with high academic achievement based on per-pupil expenditures. HB 1279 passed and has two more committee stops. From the Florida Channel, I'm Bob Brooks for Florida Public Radio.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, on last night's Capitol Report, we spoke with well-known Florida Republican strategist Rick Wilson about his take on Governor Rick Scott's relationship with President Donald Trump. We also wanted to know what Wilson thought of the odd political dynamic that's now playing itself out in the Florida legislature. Here's that conversation.
As we go through this session, though, Rick, you've got a Senate that, because of the sexual harassment and even the consenting adult syndrome that's going on right now, is pretty much the walking wounded. You have a very aggressive House Speaker in Richard Corcoran. Are we now a unicameral legislature, at least for this part of the session? How do you see that playing out?
Well, I think the session, the overhang of this session, you know, going into it, everyone was terrified. What is Jack Latvala going to do next? What bomb will he drop? You know, will this become a session of scandal? And I think that there's an opportunity for the legislature in both houses to very clearly and very sharply talk about how they're going to have an ethical and material change in the way they do business. and how they're going to govern themselves as well as governing the state. And so the Me Too issue and the sexual harassment and sexual intimidation issue that came from the Latvala scandal is still going to be one that they're going to have to bear up on. And, you know, there is always, when there is a candidate running for statewide office in one of the leadership positions in either the House or the Senate here, and I've been, you know, on both sides of this equation as a consultant to those guys, you know, they're always going to be questioned as to, are you doing this because you are, you know, seeking the good of the state? Or are you doing this as part of, to make campaign ads from? And I like Richard a lot, and Richard's a friend, and I think he's got a tremendous conservative set of bona fides, and I don't think he's manipulating the legislative process to achieve any particular end. I think he's a guy with a lot of really good conservative ideas out there. And we've also got Commissioner Putnam, who is, you know, trying to make his stamp on this legislative session. We've got a rich field of Republicans in this state for everything right now, and a lot of good arguments for all these guys. I think the pressure in some ways on the speaker right now is coming from the fact that as much as you want to be Donald Trump's friend, and I've said this before in speeches and in remarks, you're never his friend. You're never him. You're never the guy. He will pick something whimsical, and he saw Ron DeSantis on Fox News and said, oh, I like that guy. And it doesn't matter if DeSantis is electable. It doesn't matter if he's a good guy or a bad guy. And I'm not judging right now at all. It's just whimsy. It's just impulse. And then, so you get these insta decisions from the president, and they change the whole landscape of the campaign going forward. You know, everybody's trying to cut their teeth in a conservative legislature in a purple state. It's a really fascinating set of equations. And people, you know, I've done races in 38 states. I've been all over the country. And people in other places are like, you know, you guys move so fast and there are so many variables. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, we are Florida. We are this exotic third world country in some ways. And we are, you know, campaigning in Pensacola is as different as, you know, and Miami is as different as campaigning in, you know, Miami and Japan. It's a radically different set of cultures in this state. So these guys are all playing, you know, a very multivariate calculus and trying to get through a session that could make or break their campaigns.
Wouldn't live anywhere else.
Hell no. And
so happy that you can be with us to talk
about
it.
Thanks so much, John.
Share your insights. Rick Wilson, GOP strategist and consultant here on Capitol Report. Thanks, Rick. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank Andrew Quintana, our sister operation, the Florida Channel, and contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us again each weeknight at this time during the 2018 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes, offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from Florida State University, a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our community, the state, and nation. More at fsu.edu/mytag. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.